I'm Jason Bradford.
I'm Cher Miller.
And I'm Rob Dietz. Welcome to Crazy Town, where Escape from New York is not just a mediocre 80s movie, but prophecy.
Hey, this is Crazy Town producer Melody Allison. Thanks for listening. Here in Season 6, we're exploring escape routes. Pathways that just might get us out of Crazy Town. In today's episode, Jason, Rob, and Cher are escaping urbanism. And here's a quick warning. Sometimes this podcast uses swear words.
Language!
If you like what you're hearing, please let some friends know about Crazy Town. Now, on to the show.
All right. I have a question for Rob, and jump in if you have anything to contribute. You may not have shared, but
yeah, never.
All right. Well, actually, you know, you probably might.
Does anyway. That go for the whole episode?
No. I know you're the expert on 80s sitcoms.
Yes.
What was your favorite 80s sitcom?
Oh, that's a toughie. You know, I really liked Different Strokes.
Nice. I actually don't want to hear about
Facts of Life.
What I want to hear about
Hardcastle McCormick.
Was that a sitcom? Was it action?
But I want to take your mind back to the 60s, which I bet you saw these because WTBS, you know.
Yeah,
Atlanta.
Ted Turner kind of owned the city of Atlanta.
Yeah.
He had a whole, we could get this over the aerial, over the antenna.
Right.
Turner Broadcasting System.
Okay.
They played all this old stuff.
Okay.
So, yeah, I might know some 60s shows.
Okay, there was this guy, Paul Henning, a writer, producer for CBS, who had three shows that happened from the early to mid 60s, all about urban rural sort of like cultural divides, right?
Okay.
And I want you to rank them in terms of their quality. Which one is your favorite?
Can do.
Okay. Petticoat Junction.
Okay.
Gotcha. You actually know that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Of course.
Never heard of it.
Petticoat Junction.
It's the place where, you know, it's the junction where the petticoats all gather.
Okay. Petticoat Junction.
least
well known maybe of them, but big hit at the day. Green Acres.
Okay.
Awesome one.
Yes. Awesome one. Great song.
With Eddie Albert and Ava Gabor.
Fantastic.
Place to be. Yeah, because she really struck you as being a real rural woman.
Yeah.
Well, that's the thing. She was the city person moving to the.
Right. Did she have an accent?
Yeah.
You are my wife. Goodbye, city life. That kind of thing. It was great.
Oh, excellent rendition.
Thank
you. Okay, that's two shows. What's the third?
The final one. Okay. I'm a little biased towards this one, honestly.
Hey, don't. You're asking me. Don't.
The Beverly Hillbillies.
Okay. Yeah. Well, okay. Look, if you're ranking theme songs, you got to put Beverly Hillbillies at the top.
Uh-huh. Yep.
Although,
let me tell you about a story about a man named Jed, poor mountaineer, barely kept his family.
Was that an invitation
for him? One day he was shooting up some food.
The only reason
up through the ground came a bubbling crude. Oil that is.
Plus,
black gold,
Post-Carbon Institute. Could you stop it?
Okay, sorry.
Post-Carbon Institute, the oil connection there. That's pretty cool.
Uh-huh. I think actually there's a lot to draw from, but we're not going to talk about the oil world and, you know, blah blah blah, but
those two are kind of almost the opposite, though.
Yes, because one is the city people go to the country, the other is the country people
right.
go back to.
Yeah.
So anyway, rank them.
So, like I said, theme song, Beverly Hillbillies number one, Green Acres two, Petticoat Junction three.
Yeah,
enjoyment of the show as my 8-year old self or whatever, I would go Green Acres one,
interesting,
and Hillbillies two. But it's a close two with Petticoat Junction.
Okay.
I actually liked that show.
Excellent. Okay.
It was community oriented.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things
I didn't watch any of these.
Oh, I remember what was funny about it, a lot of it was the mismatch in skills as people swap locations, right? And then also the different social norms. They played upon that. You know, Granny was cooking coon and in Beverly Hills, right? And the banker would show up and mayhem, right?
Yeah, you can't be cooking
varmints.
Or some suitor would come over for Ellie Mae and she'd like, you know, wrestle him and throw him to the ground and pin him and these sort of things.
That was you as a wrestler probably appreciated that.
You know, I'm sure,
I had a crush on her for sure.
I'm sure that all Texans viewed that as a very accurate portrayal.
Well, like, there is, you know, there is
critique. Wrestling people who just walk in your house.
There is critique that it played upon stereotypes in both directions. Sure. Everybody
equal
got
equal opportunity.
Equal opportunity. The haughty city people.
How come you didn't?
They're all white though.
How come you didn't throw in Gilligan's Island, where they don't go to the city or the country? They go to a deserted island.
All right, wasn't part of the Paul Henning trilogy.
Okay. Sorry.
All right. Given that 80% of Americans now are considered urbanites, which includes cities and suburbs, I think that we forget a lot about the rural folks. And in the 60s, there was still this transition, the post-war period, where there was a lot of migration to cities from post-war America. So this was really tapping into that period in the 60s where the suburban sprawl was happening and people were getting motor cars and all the appliances and stuff like that. But now what you see now in these rural areas, I think, is a lot of the left behinds, right? And the resentment
we don't think about them except when elections come around and they make city people unhappy with who they vote for.
Well, what's interesting, what I think about it, is that at this point, everything that these urban areas need actually come from these rural areas, from all the food, the fuel, the minerals. They're all extracted from these rural areas, manufactured and then consumed in the urban ones. And so, you know, I feel like we really should be paying more attention to these areas, understand why people there might feel left behind and upset, a little bit resentful.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. But it goes farther than that, too. I agree with your point that the urban area is drawing all this resource from the rural. But nowadays, rural towns operate the same way, too. Yeah. They're not provisioning themselves the way they used to in Petticoat Junction.
No.
Yeah, nobody knows how to make their own petticoats or repair them anymore.
Right. The point is they're operating almost in the same way. You know, yes, their provisioning does come from rural areas, but probably far-flung rural areas to arrive at the Walmart.
Everything has been sort of turned upside down. And now the purportedly self-sufficient, rugged individualism of these rural areas is mostly gone.
Now, I think if people have listened to Crazy Town long enough or read anything you've ever written, Jason, would probably know that we have a critique about city life.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
We got to plug your report, The Future is Rural.
Thank you.
The writer was good, but the editor was incredible project.
I mean, the best editor.
I think the person who did the cover art is actually the best.
Unbelievable. Yeah.
Yeah, I think if you like Crazy Town, you probably like The Future is Rural.
Sure.
It doesn't use as many swear words and isn't quite as sarcastic. But,
right. Yeah, because we did a find all replace. and I didn't write it, so.
Yeah.
So a lot of the F-bombs weren't included for some reason. But in any case, I think people could view maybe our take on urbanism with a certain bias. But I would say that, you know, we have a concern that urbanism will actually be on the decline. And we should be thinking about what that means. And that's what we want to talk about today on this episode, escaping urbanism. Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
Now, before we get into that, I think we should give ourselves a little bit of space to talk about some of the things that we maybe most enjoy or not enjoy about urbanism.
Sure.
But can we just lay first a foundation for kind of what the context is, what the situation is with urbanism?
Hey, we'll go. Right. Okay, yeah. Throw some facts.
Let's do some stats at you guys. Okay.
Let's factify.
Okay. So 83% of the U.S. population right now lives in urban areas.
Okay.
That's high.
There are now over 275 million people living in cities, and that's compared to 126 million in 1960. So you were talking about, you know, those sitcoms being based in the 1960s.
Yeah.
Think about that. That's more than double.
If only Paul Henning could create sitcoms now. I mean, we'd have some true. Yeah.
We could dig him up and see if he's available. So now, interestingly, rural population actually hasn't declined since 1960. It's grown by, you know, a couple million, 3 or 4 million or something like that. But the percentage of the rural population has dropped from about 30% in 1960 to 17% now. And we're talking about 1960, which was already after many, many decades of a move towards urbanism with what we saw with the kind of the push towards industry, which we talked about before, right?
Yeah.
Now, this is happening around the world, right? So now 50% of the world population lives in urban areas. It wasn't actually that long ago. I think that there was a lot of news coverage of the fact that we passed that 50% mark.
Yeah.
So we're now like about 57%. the fastest growth is happening in quote unquote developing countries. Mm-hmm. And they saw their percentage increase in the last 10 years go up from 44%.
See, I think they got it wrong. I think the fastest urbanization is happening in urbanizing countries.
Ooh. So you had 44% of people in quote unquote developing countries living in urban areas in 2012. 10 years later, it's over 50%. But I think the key thing here is that pretty much everyone assumes that this trend line is going to continue.
I have a graph in my report about that trend line and the assumptions. So,
and
yes,
if you want to. Only continued. I mean, we saw, like, it was interesting in the United States and maybe some other countries. We saw an actual weird temporary blip of people leaving cities. Mm-hmm. And that was because people were locked up in their tiny little fucking apartments. Right, like, this sucks.
Yeah.
You know?
It might have been just Long Island or whatever.
Right.
But
and the ones that could afford to go, right, which we'll talk about, is sort of the weird division in terms of income and wealth, you know, between urban and non-urban areas. You know, some of them left. But the general trend line has been towards urbanization.
Yeah. We don't have stats on the number of urbanites who have country estates, but I'm sure that's been growing as well.
Yeah, sure. Second homes or whatever. Mm-hmm. And then the UN, in a report just a few years ago, predicted that we'll see an additional 2.5 billion people living in cities in 2050. That's two out of every three people on Earth. And they also said that the number of megacities, which is a population of over 10 million people, which is just imagine 10 million people, right?
Yeah. Like,
will grow to 43 from 31 today. So 43 cities around the world having more than 10 million people in them. And some are well more than 20 million.
Yes, right? Yes, 30 million some. 40 million greater Tokyo now, I think.
So that's just the, you know, sense of kind of like the what's been happening towards urbanization, urbanism, and what everyone's expecting is going to continue, right?
I often struggle to understand what numbers of that size mean, like what, you know, 10 million people. But I can picture, say, New York City or a place that I've been. And if we're going to get into sort of a what's wrong with this picture phase, I got to say, for me, you know, there's a lot that's easy to throw out in cities, like around traffic or whatever. But for me, it's the hardscape. Like if you can get to a high spot over a modern day city and you look out, I mean, on the one hand, it's incredible. It's marvelous. Like, wow, look at this gleaming place of glass and concrete and steel, and it's pretty intense how much we've been able to build. Like I say, on one hand, I feel like it's wondrous, but on the other, it's nightmarish too. Yeah. It's like this hardscape makes it hard for anything to live.
Right.
It runs the water off the landscape at a pace that the creeks and the rivers can't really handle. Part of me looks at it as an utter ecological disaster.
No, right. No offense, Rob, but every time I drive into Portland, I'm like, I know somebody who lives here is a total jerk. And the second thought I have is,
I'm taking a little bit of offense, but go ahead.
I said no offense.
Yeah.
So you can't be offended.
Right. Yeah.
Those are the rules.
Yeah.
Okay. No, I get bummed out. And it's not just Portland. It's like any city, if I drive into an area, and obviously I am biased. I'm not a city guy. I'll be the first person to admit it. But you drive into these, it really does feel like this weight of concrete around me. And it feels so monotonous too. It's monochrome. Bums the shit out of me.
It's actually why I left Washington, D.C., where I lived for quite a while, was that feeling of, oh man, this place doesn't have a long-term future.
No, it all decays. Yeah. Yes, I lived in St. Louis for a long time, and St. Louis was a city on the decline while I was there. It's kind of rebounded, but you can go through parts of that city that look like a bomb went off, and it's just been the decay of people moving out, the white flight to the suburbs, you know, with the highway system that got in, all the usual stories. But it's amazing. All of it just crumbles, you know, if you're not constant. And I was there, a bridge collapsed, like a bridge I used to drive over every day collapsed while I was there.
But that arch is still there.
The arch is still there. It's okay. Great.
We just keep that.
Yeah. But what gets me, and this relates to the hardscape, is the noise pollution. And so I was visiting you the other day, and I walked out in the morning and was like, wow, I'm trying to listen to these birds.
Yeah, he's visiting me at my shitty urban house.
It was a great place. It was comfortable.
Did you walk out and be like, everybody shut up, I can't hear the birds.
Well, I'm literally like, God, there's probably a towhee over there somewhere. But it's getting drowned out by this like constant background hum.
Yeah.
And it always stuns me, like that. Yeah. You can't ever get away from
it. I talked to a young person the other day who was sitting on my porch.
Yeah.
And he said he was digging the relaxation because that hum that you're talking about reminded him of the ocean.
Oh, interesting.
Which is, like having to turn that around. Like I'm listening to traffic that's far away, but that low hum is like the waves sweeping into a sandy beach.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, it turns out that noise pollution has a huge impact on wildlife. And there's a really good Netflix show called The Year of the Earth Change, where the BBC documentary people that, you know, David Attenborough and stuff, really showed you how important this noise is and how detrimental it is to creatures. So I recommend that.
Yeah, there's noise. There's also light. I mean,
Light pollution.
It's
terrible,
been documented, and it's a fascinating and tragic story of how the move towards more efficient LEDs,
right,
which a lot of people in climate and sustainability spaces have applauded, right, because they use much less electricity, create huge problems now for nocturnal creatures and birds because they're so damn bright.
Yeah, you know? They use even less electricity when you turn them off.
It's amazing. But people forgot that part.
Yeah.
They forgot it. I think we got to be careful because we're talking maybe a little bit about like really urban kind of city environments. But there's another form of urbanism, right? Which is not that dense skyscraper city, right? Where people are living in apartments. It's the sprawl of suburbia.
Yeah.
You know, the arteries that extend out from those urban centers that most people actually live in. At least in a city like in New York, you know, people they live in small apartments.
Right.
And, I think we talked about that before. You can't stock up on so much shit.
You don't have a deep freezer.
You just go down to the bodega every day or every other day to get your food. Contrast that with people driving their car, to Costco.
Right.
The great enhancements they created now where you can order your fucking 18,000 pack of,
Lay's,
chips. And get it delivered to your car so you never have to get out of your car. That's a form of urbanism too.
Look at the naming of the perfect vehicle for the suburbs, the Chevy Suburban.
Yes.
It's a gigumbous SUV that you could pull up to the Costco and fill up. Yeah.
Exactly.
I think, James Howard Kunstler wrote beautifully about this, where he didn't like a lot of urbanism too. Like he would make fun of it, but the worst for him was the suburban sprawl.
It is the worst.
And so if you read, you could just look up James, if you haven't read him before.
Watch his he has a very famous TED Talk from many, 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 many years ago. But he loves to show photos of these
and then comment.
Blights.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Well, you said he writes beautifully. I agree. But he also writes cantankerously and humorously. But, and we've all corresponded with him before. His book I read well before I got into this activist space, called The Geography of Nowhere, which is all about the suburban sprawl. And I still say, I quote him all the time, like he was making fun of how schools in these suburbs look like German shoe factories.
Minimum security prisons.
And you drive around and you see them. You're just like, there's another German shoe factory. There's another minimum security prison.
My son's high school literally looks like a prison.
Yeah.
It's awful.
Yeah.
So again, I just want to point out 83% of the U.S. population lives in urban environments, but it's really 50% of Americans lived in suburban communities.
Right.
And here's the thing. I think almost everyone agrees, even though more than 50% of Americans live in suburbia, that suburbia sucks.
Yeah, that's the worst form.
Yeah, exactly. Right. And in fact, a lot of people, point out that suburban environments are kind of like the worst, manifestation of unsustainable practices, right?
Yeah, car dependency.
Yeah, and so what they're really pushing in a lot of ways is urbanism as being much more energy efficient. People's footprints are smaller.
Right.
The amount of energy they consume for transportation if they live in a city is less. Their material footprint in terms of like the energy they consume for heating and electricity and all that stuff is less.
Per capita, per space. Yeah.
So they're trying to, they're trying to encourage people to go into cities, right? But there's a concern there. And I think this is maybe something that's worth talking about is, well, what are the risks of being in cities?
Right.
You know, and one of the big risks that people are concerned about is the impact of climate change on cities. Mm-hmm. Right. So maybe we talk about that a little bit, because there's this unanimous consensus that we're all going to be moving more into cities. So how do we make those cities more sustainable? You know, how do we make them more able to withstand climate impacts, for
right.
example?
Right.
Well, with climate, the key thing is the infrastructure getting annihilated. You know, yeah. if you've got sea level rising and your city is built right on the edge of the sea, good luck. Remember when we had Douglas Rushkoff on this program?
Oh, yeah.
And we were talking about, I don't know what the context was, but there was this big giveaway where you could win a house on Miami Beach, like an $8 million house. And right. I was like, why would I want that? It's going to be gone in a few short years. Like,
right.
Could I just get the $8 million so I could buy a house in Omaha or something?
Just flip it.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, this is a real issue with cities, with climate and the erosion of infrastructure. I mean, you've already seen, you just talked about a bridge collapse, Jason. We've seen a condominium collapse
right.
in concrete, Miami.
Yeah.
That's before you're really having these kind of severe weather impacts. So we're already in an infrastructure problem with our cities, and it's about to get a hell of a lot worse.
Well, just look around the world. I mean, so much of the human population lives in coastal areas.
Right.
Yeah. It's hard to know what the true estimates are, but you know, we're talking about tens to hundreds of millions of people that are going to probably be displaced.
Yeah, I think the stats are suggesting tens of millions just in the U.S.,
yeah.
and hundreds of millions, you know, up to a billion maybe globally, just in the coastal regions because of sea level rise. And that doesn't include other things like wildfires and severe drought, or what is it, when it gets too hot and you wet bulb temperatures, all these sort of things.
Yeah, basically your brain fries out.
Yes. Yeah. So then the term that I've seen developed around this is climigration. It's an area of research. So people like looking at maps of future climate versus contemporary climate, current population in areas that are highest risk for severe climate change versus areas that seem to be rather relatively buffered but have lower population density. And so right now, when you look at climate migration work, it tends to think about swapping one urban area for another. So for example, one of the early cities proposed was Duluth, Minnesota, which actually is on Lake Superior, and it actually had a shrinking population because of, you know, Rust Belt type issues.
Right.
But the idea is like, well, let's bring people back and
let's
just
repopulate
Duluth.
So like
half of Houston can move to Duluth or something
right.
like that.
Well, this is the problem, you know. Duluth wouldn't be able to handle half of Houston or Miami, but you get the idea.
Houston can't even handle half of Houston.
Right, right. So,
well, you know, some places are getting out ahead of the game. So have you seen that news recently? In Indonesia, the capital is Jakarta. Mm-hmm. It's one of the mega cities that you were talking about, Asher, one mm-hmm. of the current ones. I think low on the list. They've got about 10 million people, but they're having a lot of problems there with poverty and crime, but also with subsidence.
Oh, yeah. Just really, they're sinking so fast. It's incredible, the stats.
So they've decided to start a new city called Nusantara that's being built from nothing, you know, starting from scratch on Borneo.
Oh, great. Just tearing down more jungle, I'm sure.
Yeah. Well, but start a whole new green city.
Green city. Exactly. So what it looks like is that we're just going to double down on building more big cities. That's sort of what the plan is. Even though in 2020, there was this incredible report came out, one of those ones that sort of shocks you when you realize it, that there's this term that was thrown out in this report called anthropogenic mass. It's a great term, I think.
You're an anthropogenic mass.
Instead of the BMI, you know, we're going to use that.
Yes. Yeah. Well, you know what it is. If you're in a city and you're looking around, and you just see all the stuff that you talked about, Rob, the gleaming, shining glass and
right.
the concrete and the steel and all that and the asphalt strips and the cars and all this. That mass, if you add it up around the world, is now greater than biomass. So all the trees, all the soil organisms, all the grasses, all the anyway, that's just absolutely shocking.
It's another way to say that shit is heavy.
Yes, all of our shit, and 33% of this is concrete, by the way.
Right. And I think that that gets to an important point, which is we could say in some cases we're going to do managed retreat from some areas. Mm-hmm. I mean, the truth is that right now, I think we're early bargaining stages.
You know,
we're just thinking about the sort of climate impacts. And so you see like cities like New York that are looking to, you know, to build these seawalls
right,
to protect. And you look at what's happening in Venice, you know, what they're trying to do to protect that city, which would be tragic to lose Venice. So there are these efforts to basically, like, you know, raise Miami a little bit, you know, so that it's you know, not so much underwater. In many cases, you could look at that and you could say this is a fool's errand, waste of money and resources.
We just need 4.7 billion jacks. We'll put them all under under Florida,
and and everyone do it at the same time. Let's coordinate, right? And so that, you know, that's kind of maybe step one. Step two might be, you know, actually saying no, we have to retreat from these places, like maybe what they're trying to do in Jakarta, you know, or we need to think about basically saying we're not going to start a new city over here, but we're going to have people move from this city to another city. But you, as you're pointing out, Jason, like, massive amount of concrete and other material resources that go into building cities
that all decay.
That decay and also, I mean, concrete is a huge source of climate emissions.
Yeah, it's
already
one of the worst.
Right? And I know people are talking about trying to green concrete, but
the scale, it's all pathetic. Any proposal you look at, it's just ridiculous.
Enormous. And then there are other vulnerabilities, right? We're just talking about the climate impacts and trying to think about like the climate equation of that a little bit, but you know, there are other vulnerabilities of cities, you know, and we've talked about this, I think, before in the past, where we did this with our skyscraper episode, you know, like you basically have to create a hermetically sealed building, you know, and to get around, you need an elevator that functions. And so you're 100% reliant on complex machinery, computer parts.
Yeah.
Electricity being constantly available.
Right.
You know,
electricity goes out. You can't get up
and
down.
Things go out, you know, and it's not just because a storm, you know, hit you and you're down for a couple of days.
You saw the Yes Men, the episode where they had the survival pods.
Right.
You remember that? Yeah. That was awesome.
I'm sure you could get one of those and jump out of your 80th story.
That's what they promoted. You
know. I think of people like Alex Honnold and Alice, the guy Robert, I think, is a French climber.
Oh,
basically,
yeah.
these climbers.
They'll get down the skyscraper.
They will own the top penthouses of all the skyscrapers because they're the only ones who can climb them.
Right.
Now, so yeah, I think I have a little side rant this brings me to because, you know, people are all stressed out about colonialism and resources and these sort of things.
Rightfully so.
Right, totally. And I know that a lot of liberals, you know, they live in the you know, they might be bi-coastal or whatever, and they look at the flyover states and these people are voting differently than they are, and they're grumbling about how, you know, our tax dollars are really supporting you people in these low density areas. We're supporting you with food stamps, and we're supporting you with the taxes to maintain your roads and the telecommunications and all the grants you get because we make all this money and we pay our taxes, and you poor people in these poor towns don't pay your fair share. And I just look at this and I go like, excuse me, but that's all about money. The rural people are poor because of urban colonialism, in a sense. This internal colonialism, and it affects our politics. But if you're in an urban environment, every single thing that you touch, that you buy in a store, is coming from some rural area. And some person has been paid probably way less than you'd accept to get that to you.
Yeah.
Okay. So anyway, yes, you are completely dependent on the input from that external area and from that rural environment. And guess where your waste goes? Guess where your trash goes? So anyway,
it goes away.
What do you mean? It all gets recycled, Jason.
So this reminds me. I like to visualize this stuff. So you guys know that show and that book, Under the Dome.
It's like Truman Show.
Take a glass dome. Well, yeah. Take a glass dome and put it over, say, a large area on Earth.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, what happens? How do you live there?
Uh-huh.
Well, I like to think about it. Like, if you took a glass dome or plexiglass and you dropped it over.
Polycarbonate.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Some kind of good material.
Yeah.
Maybe a concrete one. I don't know. But you dropped it over Manhattan.
Uh-huh.
How long can people provision themselves in Manhattan and continue to live and thrive? I mean, not Not real long because of what you're talking about.
Days.
Yeah, I mean, until the bodega shelf runs out.
Yes.
Whereas if you dropped a big dome over where we're sitting now, you would probably last quite a bit longer because there's viable farmland.
Yeah.
There's still intact ecosystem. It's not great. It would still be a struggle. Yeah. It's not like we're ready to do away with trade and imports and exports.
Does the internet still work through the dome? Because I still need my Netflix.
Yeah.
It's all smoke signals.
You know, I write this, The Future is Rural, and it has a lot of these elements in it, critiquing the sustainability of cities. And then I will get comments like, but we have always had cities. And then I have to remind people that every ancient city has collapsed. Okay. Now, for various reasons that you can read about, Tainter or Jared Diamond work or whatever. But the other thing to think about is if you look though at these pre-industrial cities in their prime, in their heyday, in their glory days, we can learn something about what allows a city to persist for quite a bit long time. And there's a few things that are important. A lot of these past cities, they were very dense, so they weren't like the suburban sprawl, okay? But those dense places had land resources right outside the city. And so it's sort of the surface area. You can think of like the surface area to volume of that city was appropriate. So that wasn't that hard to get stuff in and out using donkey carts or whatever.
That's my favorite video game, donkey carts.
And you can imagine like, you know, you ever been to Tuscany, Italy, where you got these like hill towns or whatever. And it's just like, you know, Siena, Italy is just incredible, right? It's a city, it's a dense city, but cascading through the countryside, right outside of it, are these farms and vineyards and stuff.
Yeah, plus the sea is there for...
Well, seaports like Venice, for example. There's a very wealthy city. They aren't growing a lot of food in Venice, but trade and is really easy because it's a port.
Istanbul,
huge. That was one of the biggest cities in the world for a long time. And it's probably got the most amazing trade location possible.
Constantinople as well.
Yeah.
There's a lot of commonality between those two cities for some reason.
Now, the other way that people had cities in the past were actually the opposite. They were very expansive cities. They were not dense. But these people were essentially, they were like city gardens. These were horticultural societies. Mm. So ancient Mexico City was sprawling. It was about the size of contemporary Greater Los Angeles, but it had 1/10 of the population of Greater Los Angeles. And basically, most people were working as sort of these like small-scale farmers. So that's what we have to understand, is that it was exceedingly rare in history to have a city even get to 1 million. Whereas today, obviously, we talked about how many are mega cities of 10 million, but there's over 500 cities that are 1 million people right now.
A takeaway for me from what you're describing, Jason, is that there are different ways to arrange the city.
Yeah.
And we'll get into this when we hit our, you know, our visions for a different infrastructure and do the opposite. But you know, you guys gently, by not offending me, introduced the fact that I live in a city.
Yeah.
I suspect a large percentage of our listeners live in cities.
And we don't want to offend any of them. And they're important.
Well, it's not so much that. We offend people all the time, but it's more, you get what you pay for here, people.
Yeah.
But no, it's more that not everyone can get out of a city, you know, like if you think like an escape route is leave the city,
right?
Some of us are kind of there for various reasons and are stuck. And so I just want to make sure that, you know, we're going to cover, there are ways to escape the worst problems of the city while still being in the city. You know, there's all these things like different transportation systems. I mean, we know how much I've talked about bikes and loving them. And there's this idea of the 15-minute city where it's like if you live in a city, but you could get to everything with personal transport, non-motorized, within 15 minutes, like
that's pretty
good. Would be pretty cool.
People will walk then,
And I've had weird visions lately about cities with less hardscape. Like, could you just undo some of this road build out that we've done?
Like city repair in Portland did a lot of work like that.
Yeah, and have like paths and trees and food forests and, you know, that kind of stuff.
Okay, I'm sorry if I felt harsh. I love Melbourne, for example. I've never been there, but they have the Australian Open. You know, I care a lot about cities, especially in Australia, where we're very popular.
You're really kissing the Aussies' butts here.
I know.
I think it's a really good point, Rob, because there's degrees, right? So we talked about how in many ways suburbia is far worse than dense urban, you know, environments. We also see differences in terms of how cities or different countries have gone about trying to make either the quality of life in cities better or to actually make them more sustainable. And if you look at the relationship between transportation and population density, right?
Yeah.
It's really interesting to see, like, you compare some U.S. cities to European cities, right, for example, or look at Tokyo, and ours are far worse in terms of, like, the amount of transportation-related energy that is being consumed in those cities. And I think a lot of it has to do with the history.
Yeah.
And we talk a lot about infrastructure and as driving things. A lot of our cities have evolved in the age of the car, right?
Yeah.
And we prioritize that.
We were the first to develop massive oil reserves.
So many of these European cities, they've existed for hundreds and hundreds of years before fossil fuels came around, before the car came around. And so they're built in a way that's a lot more friendly to pedestrian use.
Yeah. And that's why we love to go visit them with using jet fuel.
If you were to break it down too, like if you took a U.S. city and went to the core that was built pre-automobile, I'm sure the people living there are using less energy for transportation than those living in that, suburban.
Well, like old New Orleans or old Boston or even St. Louis has placed neighborhoods like that. Yeah. It's incredible.
Now, back to the Aussies. They're actually weirdly, anomalous in kind of this charting because they're more efficient in terms of transportation, energy consumption than American cities, but they're also relatively new cities that we're talking about. So I'm not sure what the Aussies have done. Maybe our Aussie friends could tell us.
I think because they didn't have their oil reserve, so they were developing post-World War II.
Yeah, it's too bad it wasn't coal-fired
cars. They didn't have enough
cars.
Yeah.
Yeah, too bad.
So we go on a critique of urbanism, but we also need to look at why we're in this situation we're in. Why does it draw us in? Mm-hmm. And I think one of the biggest reasons we get drawn into cities, at least here in the US and my experience, is that's where the jobs are, mm-hmm. right? Not just the jobs exist, but the high paying jobs as well. And it's important that, at least I think, to understand that's utterly sensible,
right?
I mean, you're going to stay in the countryside and not be able to get the money and all the power that comes with that and all the choices that it opens up.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty bad beat to say, stay put.
Well, and this all stems back to industrialization. You know, we talked about it in our episode on industrialism, escaping that. You know, this is driven by the fact that, you know, we industrialized the economy, right? We mechanized a lot of things. We created a situation where we wanted to consolidate labor and manufacturing into certain places to maximize efficiency. Mm-hmm. So we move people into cities and we paid them higher wages to do that. They've created this downward pressure on wages. When we industrialized the food system, basically people left the farm. You know, it was a lot cheaper just to pour a bunch of fossil fuel energy on top of crops than it was to put human labor to it. So we actually started paying laborers a lot less, farmers a lot less.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really driven by kind of an economic system that we created and that we mechanized the living shit out of everything. And it's also no coincidence that, you know, Jason, you've talked a lot about the primary, secondary, tertiary economies. You know, the people who kind of set economic policy, you know, the industrialists and the economists who support all that, they get paid the highest wages because they're rewarding their own value in a sense.
Yes. You know? What are the things that's gone up in cost faster than just about anything else are housing costs, right?
Yeah.
And there's a huge like stress in our society for that. And you think about like these cities have this demand, more people are showing up. There's a lot of the jobs are there. The jobs pay better. Therefore, people can afford houses that are more expensive. But then there's these weird dynamics. But it's just, you know, I just find it's outrageous. And of course, then you need finance to get the house. You can't pay cash, which, you know, means you're in debt. You've got a mortgage.
But those are good jobs in finance.
Yeah, exactly. And so now you need a high-paying job to maintain this mortgage for this very expensive house, which is your only choice if you're in the city to get the high-paying job. It's just this like circular kind of craziness.
Positive feedback.
And it just like the cities are sucking in resources and they're sucking in labor, you get to a place where there is especially with these densities, right? There is such housing pressure and the costs are so high that people can't afford it. And then that creates the surge of people leaving because they can't afford to live in the city where the jobs are. So they have to now live in exurbs, you know.
Yeah, then commute in.
And then they have to fucking live in their car, right. You know, to drive into work, well, right? And that's the whole highway system that we've reinforced. And it's just, we talk about it as sprawl, but it's basically this metastasizing dynamic of this.
Well, that's one of the stats you forgot to mention before. You said 50% of Americans live in the suburbs. Yeah. Well, by 2050, 50% will live in suburbans. The cars.
The cars, exactly. You're right. Yeah. Which, you know, I mean, at least the, you know, we talked about downsizing
homes.
It's
a big car.
It's a big car, but smaller than a house.
Right. This is a message to all you crazy townies out there. Sometimes Jason, Asher, and I wish you could be here in the room with us when we're riffing on eco-modernist nightmares, the end of capitalism, the collapse of civilization, and lines from Arnold Schwarzenegger movies. Since you can't be here, maybe we could still be in contact in another way. If you've got a comment about the show, or you want to throw some shade at us, or you got a question,
or you have a suggestion of escape route stuff.
Yeah. Maybe you got a story of your own you want to share. Go over to Apple Podcasts or iTunes and leave us a review and write your comment there. In your comment, include your idea, whatever it is, and we'll think about sharing it in an episode.
How's this? I'll be back. Is that any good?
Oh my God, that's terrible.
You try it.
Get to the chopper! We're rededicating ourselves to listener feedback this season, and I've got a...
that was a mallet that almost fell on Jason's head. Keep going, Rob.
It's like a Three Stooges episode.
Let's keep this in. Keep going, Rob.
Okay, so we're rededicating ourselves to listener feedback this season, and we got a note from Dean or Danae. Sorry if I'm mispronouncing that. This person says, I recently found Post Carbon Institute via r/collapse.
That's of course, a Reddit. That's the place to go.
I think my son's on that.
Yeah. And it talks about there was a comment in there providing resources. So I guess they found us there. Just wanted to say that I appreciate your effort and podcast. My husband and I spend pretty much all our time talking about what you share on your podcast. And the weirdness of how business as usual is still chugging along. Keep up the good work from your supporters and listeners in Nebraska.
Oh, nice.
That is great. I'm so glad you have a husband who will, you know, talk to you about this stuff.
You guys are taking this the wrong way. I was thinking of it like, wow, you spend a lot of time processing Crazy Town episodes. I'm sorry that we've done this to you.
Well, I think they found us recently, so they've been doing this for a while, I guess.
Right.
And so I'm glad that they can talk to, they can listen to us instead of each other for a while.
Right, yeah. True crazy townies. So, glad to have you along. Thank you. Okay, here we are in the Marvin Harris Memorial Lens of Doom. Quick reminder, this is about infrastructure, which is the physical environment and the stuff that surrounds us. It's about structure, which is the set of policies and rules that we follow. And it's about superstructure, the culture and belief systems.
All right.
So if we're talking about the infrastructure of the city, one of the first things we got to just look at is, here's this density of human habitation, but in order to make that work, you got to have this major modification of the landscape, right? Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I think about a lot, I mean, you could do all kinds of stuff. Look at the power lines, look at the skyscrapers, look at the communication systems. But the one that kind of strikes a nerve with me is the buried creeks.
Yeah, it's incredible. Yeah.
Like, if you guys ever look at watershed maps, like, they're so cool, all the little streams and arterial bits flowing together into bigger streams. And when you look at a map of a city, you're sort of like, there's not that much water because so much of it has been buried. And there's actually an ecological restoration process called daylighting the streams, mm-hmm. you know, where you're trying to actually get these things above ground again. Yeah. It just feels like how irreverent and just ignorant and dumb were we to bury streams and put them into pipes.
Yeah.
If you think about the infrastructure, I was just thinking about how dynamic cities are, right? In terms of like culture and all that stuff.
All the wonder stuff.
Yeah. But if you think about the infrastructure, not just of like dense urban cities, but the suburbia, which is where most Americans kind of live in, there's a homogeneity actually about it that has to do with this sort of this combination of kind of efficiency and scale and also consolidation of like business. So almost every fucking kind of suburban environment looks the same, right? You have these wide roads, these strip malls, all with their kind of like, you know, Applebee's and whatever.
Sure.
You know, it's...
you're right.
It's like, a hellscape.
Your landmarks...
And it looks the same. It's like, where am I? Yeah. I could be anywhere
the
in the country.
Geography of nowhere.
Yeah. You're right. And your landmarks become like the McDonald's arches or whatever, you know, beacons of commercial crap. Like, right. That's how you navigate the place.
Okay, let's move on to structure then. And these are the rules, right? Cities create this incredible dependency, right? The individual is now dependent. They have money, they have a job, they have money, but they're dependent for transactions, monetary transactions that allow them to survive, to provide them the goods and services they need. And you're sharing then all this public space. So in order to survive, in order for this to all to hold, to be cohesive, there are so many rules that keep the peace and legislate and enforce, like with police and lawyers, as well as these cultural norms you have to obey. So as soon as you get into a city, and this is what you learn with the Beverly Hillbillies showing up in Beverly Hills, they all of a sudden don't understand the rules, right?
Yeah. That's a documentary, right?
Yeah.
So then superstructure, right? I mean, I think this is probably fairly obvious, but, you know, there is this ubiquitous belief that city life and urbanism is progress, right? Mm-hmm. Those things are just absolutely sort of wedded and connected to one another. And so the belief system that supports urbanism is sort of this mythology that, one, cities are actually more sustainable. Right. You know?
Yeah, how many times have you read that article over and over where it's like, downtown Manhattan is the greenest place in the United States.
Right.
Yeah, and we were talking about, you know, the impacts of climate on cities, you know, and the idea is not like, let's move away from the complexity of cities and the vulnerability of cities. It's like doubling down on it, you know? And even the idea that the way we could save nature is all of us to like move more into packed cities, you know, so we could save half of Earth or whatever it is, you know, we can conserve these wild areas
and separate ourselves even more.
Completely separate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that ties in also to the culture of urban superiority, the word urbane versus provincial.
Yeah.
And the urbanites know they're urbane and they know that the, you know, the hicks like Jason and, and I guess to a lesser
Jason's
extent.
Jason's a landed squire.
Yes. Thank you.
So he's not as much of a country bumpkin.
Not yet. I'm trying.
He's got a PhD, dude.
But I mean, that it ties back to your sitcoms too, Jason. Yeah. I mean, that's like the Beverly Hillbillies were the Beverly Hillbillies, right? And the guy coming in from the city was out of place. They looked down on their neighbors, right?
Right.
And they,
what was the name of the school you guys tried to beat up in high school?
Yeah, Tucker High School. We were Henderson High School, and we had Farmer Day. I've mentioned that a couple times to denigrate those hicks that were from the rival high school.
Well,
utterly ridiculous.
Utterly ridiculous. Now, here's something that we're kind of dissing on cities, and I often get this response as sort of when we talk about this topic, right? The concerns that we present, like limits, for example, you'll often get the Stone Age didn't end for the lack of stones. Okay. So the limits to building all this stuff, like we're going to double the anthropogenic mass and there's limits to that. No, it didn't. We have technology, right? So it's that kind of thing.
Yeah, we'll green it. We'll recycle shit, whatever.
And then, you know, we talked about adapting to limits, and being truly sustainable in our lifestyles. We're going to get into that and do the opposite, where we, you know, the simplification, the kind of more rural, small organic farms, the whole like pastoral romanticism that we'll be accused of, obviously. Right. And you'll get a comment like, you all want us back living in caves, do you?
Of course. That's all of our do the opposites. That's the first thing we propose. Go live in a cave.
Yeah. Now, I want
people don't realize is we actually have created a whole franchise of do your own cave building.
Oh,
nice.
Yeah.
Nice. I was not aware of this.
It's going to be awesome. But tell me, who's the better caveman? The rugged
Captain Caveman.
The rugged Neanderthal, you know, you can imagine from the past, or today's modern urbanite? So the modern urbanite wakes up in their own cave. They have their own personal cave, right? Maybe they share with the family. And then they
got like 600 count, thread count on their sheets.
They do. They're comfortable
like
in their
4,000 square foot cave.
They're comfortable in their cave. And then they get into a mobile cave and the door lifts on their garage and they drive in their mobile cave and then they park in another garage.
Yeah.
And then they get into a little elevator cave that takes them to their office cave. And then they sit at their desk in their office cave all day.
In a cubicle.
In a cubicle.
Which is a little cave within a cave.
Right. Yeah. And then they're like, I've been sitting on my ass all day, so I gotta get some exercise. So then they get back in their little auto cave and then they drive to their workout cave. Yeah. And then, you know, they're on a little treadmill.
Yeah.
Right, to get some exercise, you know, chasing something on a screen and then, or Peloton, I don't care.
Yeah.
But get your exercise in your cave. And then they get back in their little transport cave and go back to their home cave. They don't really have to be outside much, except for maybe some little flickers of transition.
Life.
So,
because you can, at least you can regulate the temperature the whole way through, man. You could be in the same temperature the whole time.
I know. So, I mean, tell me, who's the better caveman? I mean, the caveman sleeps in a cave, might have a fire in a cave, but you know, what are they doing? They're looking outside maybe on the clear night sky and studying the stars, or they walk around, they know all the local plants and animals, right? They're the fungi, and it's like, come on.
I think you just figured out how to deflect that question or that comment when it comes at you. Like, you're giving a talk and someone says, well, you just want us to go live in a cave. You just shout at them how they live in a cave and do that little description you just did.
Mike,
you said you already live in a cave.
Mike fucking drop.
Every decision I've ever made in my entire life has been wrong. My life is the complete opposite of everything I want it to be.
If every instinct you have is wrong, then the opposite would have to be right.
Okay, here we are in the Do the Opposite, and I hope some of our listeners at least can empathize with me as a city dweller.
Mm-hmm.
I'm in the relatively small city of Portland, Oregon, but a city nonetheless.
Would you call it relatively
small? It's like 2.5 million people in the greater Portland.
More than half the population in the entire state of Oregon.
Okay, it's not fucking Tokyo, but give me a break.
Coming from our two rural friends, sure. Yeah, it's a massive, gigantic, biggest
city. It is. It's huge. It's 2.5 million people.
It's a big city.
Jeez. Okay, go on. Sorry.
Well, this is taking some wind out of my sails, but despite all this
he's trying to put a pig on a lipstick on a pig.
Okay, no, I'm trying to put a pig on the lipstick, all right? So I think we got to look at how are there ways that we can make a go of it in the city? And I, you know, for some of our listeners who, as we've talked about, are in Sydney or Melbourne or Seattle or
Brisbane,
New York City or wherever,
Auckland.
You know, we'd like to offer something. And so one of the ways I've been thinking about is kind of this application of permaculture principles, like trying to cycle and recycle as much energy and material as you can.
Mm-hmm.
And in a city, there's actually some advantage, some more ability to do this. An example that I have in my yard, I've got these grapes that we planted when we moved in.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, for a grape, you need grapevines, you need something for it to climb on. And we had a fence and I made a trellis for these grapevines to go on out of a used futon frame that I found.
Right.
Okay?
Right.
So much garbage to reuse and repurpose.
Yeah. You know, and it's just a wooden frame, right?
Sure.
That worked,
all over.
Worked well for
I had an alley in St. Louis, and you could get all kinds of shit back there, for sure.
And I do think that the proximity of people being that close does set up for easy sharing, you know?
Right.
There's a lot of crap I don't have to own that I can borrow from my neighbors who just love the way I come over and ask them for stuff all the time.
Yeah, that is nice.
I guess it's maybe another way of saying what you're talking about, Rob, is that you could sort of downscale the intensity of your consumption and your participation in the entropy engine that is right. the city.
Yeah, right? It's like, how much are you exploiting new resources out of the countryside versus, hey, we've put in all this investment and built this massive place that's got a shit ton of stuff in it.
Right.
What can I use that's already here?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, good for you. Nice try.
And we have grapes.
Yeah. And then you have a few grapes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So I, of course.
Bastard.
You can live for a long time on those.
What a bunch of asses I work with. Jeez.
You're just pissed you left Corvallis.
Yeah, I know. I just, about 20 years ago, I basically decided I was going to learn how to farm. So that was sort of my thing. Honestly, I decided, oh my gosh, I don't know anything. I can't take care of myself at all. I'm pathetic. You know, a lot of self-loathing. And so I decided to learn how to farm. And luckily I had a wife who'd support me. If you don't have money, find someone that who loves you who does. And I was
This is your escape route.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is your advice to everyone.
How to be a gold digger by yeah. Jason Bradford.
And so they gave me the breathing room, right, to like learn new skills. And I think that's an important perspective is that some of us are going to have breathing room to do something really dramatic like that, like what I did. And others are going to have to take more modest steps depending on your situation.
I think it's true that it's really hard to give people sort of do the opposite advice. Not knowing what their circumstances are. Yeah. And I think a lot of it is circumstantial. It depends on the situation that you're in. Mm-hmm. You know, in my case, you know, I've been on a gliding path towards less and less urbanism in my life. My wife and I lived in Amsterdam after we graduated. She graduated college, which is a city I enjoy very few cities, but that was one I really did enjoy a lot. We moved back to California. We're living in Silicon Valley and the peninsula. And we're like, this is insane. Mm-hmm. I was working in San Francisco and doing that commute, hated it. And we're like, we got to move out of here. So we moved up to Sonoma County.
Yeah.
You know,
much mellower. Yeah.
There's a whole transition there where we're still living in a city, the largest city in that county.
Santa Rosa, right?
In Santa Rosa. Yeah.
That's a small city.
Well, it's smaller than Portland for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
I grew up in the East and the South. You know, like the cities I was used to are Atlanta, Philadelphia, Washington.
Right.
So Portland feels like kind of a quaint city to me.
Okay.
But even, you know, I was there for 15 years. And even in the 15 years I was there, you know, we're talking about these trends. I was feeling that the city was growing and becoming more congested. And actually, it kind of affected the way that people behave. Just like the worst of both worlds in a sense. Like, it wasn't dense enough and it wasn't designed well enough to support people actually really living. Like, you know, I mean, some people live downtown, but there's very little housing that was right in the heart of downtown. And in fact, in Santa Rosa, they cut downtown in half with a highway.
I know, it's terrible.
Right? It's just awful.
Awful.
Okay. So it was like, you still were completely car dependent. And we kind of hated that, you know, and we're like, we got to get out of here. And I, you know, I'm also an example of in some ways, a pre climate refugee, mm-hmm. you know, like, worried about what was happening, seeing the trend lines in terms of what was happening with the environment going the wrong direction, going through drought there. And so we moved to a much smaller city, which is still a city. Corvallis is still a
city.
Which
I think we convinced you to come here.
I was looking in this area and, you know, it still very much feels like a city. It has a lot of downsides of a city, but it also affords a lot more opportunity to be connected to land and to still feel a sense of community. It sort of allows me to imagine living in a way where I'm much less dependent upon this sort of industrialized, globalized system.
What I remember about your move, it was intense because you got here and then Santa Rosa burned like a few months later.
God, that was crazy.
Yeah, and I was not responsible for that.
You weren't throwing matches and lit cigarettes.
No, it was really weird. You know, if 4 months later, friends, family impacted people we know, a colleague at PCI, she lost her home on the fire. My in-laws had to flee in the middle of the night. Really scary. You got within a mile of our former home. And it wasn't that I predicted that fire to happen necessarily, but seeing the risks that were coming. And there was a lot of people, when we left, they're like, why are you leaving California? You know, and then, getting calls afterwards, like, tell me about your move.
You guys got a spare bedroom. Well, I mean, let's look at some visions then for different infrastructure. Like, what can we do differently? And the first thing we could do is import Godzillas. So they'll just come in and wreck our cities.
Okay, I don't think that's going to go over well.
I don't know. It might. Okay. It might. No.
Well, it has to be coastal cities, right?
Godzilla? Yeah, he rises from the ocean.
Comes out from the ocean.
Yeah, okay. No, you can come by, walk up the Columbia River and get to Portland, maybe.
Yeah, great. Okay. Thanks. No, I think it's different prescriptions for wherever you are. So if you're in a city, then the infrastructure is as much of that 15-minute city vision as possible, and less the hardscapes and trying to set it up in a way that does require less of that transportation energy that you were talking about, Asher. If we're talking about a suburb, as much of this idea, David Holmgren's book, Retro Suburbia, where you take what you've got, but you start altering it to need less energy.
You have some land. You have some land to draw from in suburbia in many cases. Yeah. Correct. Mm-hmm.
And if you're talking about the country, I don't want us to romanticize that the non-urban places are sustainable. In many ways, they're a mess too, right? The soil's all depleted. The only way to get around is a private automobile.
A big-ass truck, actually.
Yeah, a BAT, big-ass truck. So the idea in the country is more of the village, more of the shire, right? Mm-hmm. We want to live like hobbits.
Correct.
Little holes in the hillside.
Yes.
Yeah, and in all of these different living arrangements, it's about having less dependence on consumer goods and services. You're more reliant on local sources for your livelihood.
More futon frames to construct your trellises out of.
Participating more in a sharing economy, mutual aid stuff, repair shops. It's not just food growing. It's sort of all of that.
Yeah. And, you know, I think if there was more of this livelihood in place type of economy, there would be less people in the sort of tertiary sector we talked about. You know, it's interesting. America has 25% of the world's attorneys and 5% of the world population, right? And that's almost a requirement for the complexity we have.
Sorry to go off this little tangent, but you know Flying Spaghetti Monster, Church of the Flying Spaghetti Monster?
I've heard of it. I don't know anything about it.
Oh, it's fantastic. Well, the guy who started that, this is a long story, but he basically was joking about weird correlations between things. So he showed a chart that showed that there's a correlation between the number of pirates and global warming, because they both started like at the same time, the decline of pirates and the rise of global warming.
And then the
right?
premise is that, yes, piracy is what's responsible for the
degree. Right. So what you're saying is, 5% of the world population is in the U.S., 25% lawyers. It's the same thing with emissions.
Yes.
So I think you can infer there that all lawyers are responsible for emissions.
And there's a pretty close link.
I think that's true.
Close link between lawyers and piracy. Similar career.
I have friends and family who are attorneys, so I'm not trying to make this personal. I'm just saying.
You already did. Sorry,
you're
going
to get sued, buddy.
Well, I have one of my favorite cartoons is these two peasants, and they're outside their little hovel, or whatever. And there's these two attorneys that are standing with their like suitcases and their suits.
Briefcases.
Right? Briefcases. And that one peasant is saying to the other, "They seek food, but all they can offer is representation." And it's favorite because it's this infrastructure, you know, kind of like disconnect happening.
Yeah.
And I think that's true. Like, right. If we have this changed society, we're going to need a lot less attorneys. There'll be a lot more informal rules that take place and more autonomy, less administrivia. I think most of us feel overwhelmed by the kind of the bullshit of complexity of our society. And there'll almost be a relief.
I long for some administrative simplicity, especially in the world of insurance, whether you're talking about medical, auto, home, whatever it is. Like, wouldn't it be nice if you knew what you were buying, you knew what you were paying for? How refreshing that might be.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to go into tangent about this, but like, you could definitely see a possibility that we're going to see a reversal. We're talking about the reversal of urbanism. We might see a reversal in terms of like how people get the kind of insurance support that they need. I remember John Michael Greer wrote a great piece years and years ago about the societies that used to exist in small town America.
Yeah.
The Longfellow's Halls and Oddfellows.
Oddfellows, yeah.
Yeah, sorry.
Longshoremen.
Longshoremen. I was thinking about poetry.
Yeah.
And they would actually pool funding together. They would provide health insurance for one another. You know, they basically created their own mechanisms for doing that. So you don't, because you have relationships with people, you can figure out your own agreements with things. You don't need to have a lawyer draft a contract between you, you know, or have a big insurance company, you know, doing stuff all the time. On the superstructure side, you're talking about living in a cave, right? Mm-hmm. So no wonder you live in a cave, you know, you're not exposed to nature really at all.
Yeah.
You know, no wonder we worship, you know, we worship the things that give us, you know, that are beamed into our lives, you know, and that's technology for the most part. And
yeah,
the
you guys, behind that. You guys ever been in one of those sushi restaurants with the conveyor belt?
Oh, that
brings it. That's what I worship.
Do you?
The food just comes right to my face.
Exactly. But you know, if we're not in that kind of built environment,
right.
It actually allows us to be exposed. You talked about listening to birdsong.
Right, right.
You know what I mean? Seeing stars at night.
Yes.
You know, it could reorient our cosmology, our understanding of our relationship with the rest of the world and our place in it, and allows kind of a different way of being and believing what we're here for and and not necessarily what we worship, but what we value.
Right.
Yeah. I think this ties into what people are at their cores. Like we're sort of ingenious creatures, and we look around at our landscape and we're like, oh, I can fit in here by doing this or that, building things that are commensurate with the space we live in and that use the materials nearby. And I think people are pining for this different way of interacting with ecosystems, with nature around them. And this is going to sound kind of sad, but one of the reasons I think that is from some of the YouTube videos I've been watching recently. There's this subculture of what I would call bushcraft-type videos. Of the, like, I watched this one of this guy essentially putting a water wheel in so he could mill logs and create a little cabin. And he did all this with hand tools.
Right.
It's like, it's incredible artistry. It's totally small scale.
And these guys video this stuff. That's what's amazing too. They do all this and somehow they're videoing
it. Yeah, I don't know how they're dealing with all that, but it's sort of like a middle path, right?
Did you find it slightly ironic?
Yeah, it is wonderful. I've seen those too. I love them. And what's interesting is I've traveled around the world, Latin America, Madagascar, Southeast Asia, South Pacific Islands. And I've been to these places where you look and you go, oh, these people that are living here built this, you know, they built their own home out of the materials around them. And it is absolutely fascinating. And so I even had a student at OSU call me.
Oregon State University.
Call me wanting to build his own home on my farm to live in for his last year, his senior year. Because he said, I could do this. I know how materials we would get, and they would take me some time. He never did it. He kind of didn't plan it enough ahead of time. But the idea that there was a 20-something-year-old kid who was like, I want to build my own home out of local materials. Like, my God, I haven't seen that here. Like, I haven't seen something like that here, but I've seen it other parts of the world. So freaking why not, right? It's a lot cheaper than the average home in Corvallis, which is like $500,000.
Yeah. All right, so where are these visions being achieved? Where are examples that we see around the world? Who's doing it? And I was just thinking about at sort of different scales, right?
Yeah.
So there's the individual scale. There's lots of examples of people kind of doing that on a homesteading basis, you could say.
Right.
There's the Global Ecovillage Network, which is a network of ecovillages all around the world. And some of them are quite large scale. There's some, they even have these kind of hubs where they're in some countries around the world where they have these concentrated collection of ecovillages that actually work with one another. Do you know what I mean? So they're not isolated.
Right,
they're not
right.
disconnected, but they're that more like that Shire example that we're talking about, you know, where they're growing a lot more of their own food, more sustainable infrastructure in terms of like homes that they build, you know, and that's in a lot of cases, people kind of stepping outside of urbanism and going off to places or maintaining communities like that. But then you look at examples of suburban manifestations of this, and And back to Sonoma County, where I came from, our friend Trathan Heckman started a group called Daily Axe, and they do amazing work. It's now, you know, lots of people doing it all over Sonoma counties, but it started in a town called Petaluma. And basically, it was just helping neighbors transform their small suburban plots of land to become, using permaculture, to produce as much of their own food and harvesting water, just in these incredible landscapes, you know, and doing it collaboratively. So you're not doing it on your own.
Right.
You know, they would do these workshops together. They would do these tours of other people's properties. They would have these work parties that they would do, you know, these big mulching parties and other stuff.
I really like this idea of thinking like a homesteader, no matter where you are, but then having a collaborative team of people around to help you with it.
Well, that's the way it's done. If you look at peasant communities, right? You mentioned the Shire, you know, for example, like you can actually go visit these hobbit houses in New Zealand and tour, and they're wonderful. It looks fantastic.
The hobbits invite you right in.
Yeah. And so anyway.
Elijah Wood is just right
there.
You
got to pass through Mordor on the way, unfortunately.
But some of these eco-villages almost like approach that in terms of, you know, the natural building materials used and stuff. It can be quite spectacular and lovely. But again, often what it is people will come together and do like the Amish barn raising type thing, like or they call these permi blitzes, where you just come in and help someone get their yard set up. The other thing is to realize that there are all these peasant cultures around the world that are struggling for one reason or another, and if you can find a way to help them. So I know some people that go and provide some healthcare for people in Guatemala, and they put in these masonry rocket stoves that help really dramatically cut their wood use and their pollution in their homes. Mm-hmm. In Wales, there's the One Planet development programs that are going on that help people move to rural areas and plan for and implement essentially sort of, you know, small homesteady eco-village type situations where they're mostly doing livelihood in place.
Yes, the majority of the world now is living in urban environments, but there's still many, many people who aren't. And if we're thinking about examples and, you know, places to learn from, it's looking at the global south, the communities that have not become overdeveloped yet, who are maybe maintaining a more traditional, non-urbanized way of life, and particularly indigenous communities. Yes. So it's actually sort of in all of our interest to support those to continue to exist, because the more we urbanize, in a sense, the more we're all participating in the destruction of the natural world, which is going to lead to the destruction of our...
And placing demands on their landscapes for the production of the coffee from them and the tropical oils. Or the rare minerals. Exactly. Yeah. These people get just destroyed by our demand.
So supporting groups like Cultural Survival and other organizations are working to protect, you know, the traditional way of life of indigenous communities, I think is really key. Mm-hmm. You know, so I got to say, like, some of these examples we're talking about, I mean, they're wonderful. Jason, what you're doing is great here. We talked about Daily Axe and the Global Eco Village Network and other examples of things that people are doing, that student who want to build his own know, house, dwelling, you know, on your property. Those are great, but they're such small scale, you know? Mm-hmm. And if we're recognizing, we talked about climate driving, you know, huge challenges to urban population centers all around the world. And we're saying that cities in large part are unsustainable the way that they're constructed. And we're going to be seeing a reversal of that. Are we preparing for this at all? You know, we're talking in some ways about sort of like people sort of voluntarily stepping out, you know, de-urbanizing themselves, even if they stay in an urban environment, you know, but like, what are we doing to prepare for this movement of people coming out of cities, or to support that to happen?
Absolutely nothing.
Yeah.
I mean, I get it. So I know. I tried to prep this show and try these like examples that are inspiring. And at some point you kind of go, but we're talking about the need for maybe tens, hundreds of millions of people to relocate and to de-urbanize and learn all these skills. And that, you know, they got to watch the YouTube videos that you're talking about of bushcrafting, and they've got to come into a new place and adapt. I don't know. I mean, the problem is that the superstructure that we live in now won't accept the situation. Like you said, that we're in the bargaining phase, right? And denial and everything. There's a lot of phases we have to go through to get to, you know, thinking about this correctly. And eco-modernism is highly favored.
Yeah.
So what you're asking is, if society wasn't completely bonkers and would maybe listen to some of this stuff, what would we say? Is that what, that's what you're getting
at? Yeah. Well, I think the vision is there for us. So you guys know how much I love geography and looking around on Google Earth and stuff. And mm-hmm. I was talking to some folks in Ohio, and it's amazing. You look at the sort of Cleveland to Akron corridor, mm-hmm. These big urban areas. And to the east, you've got forests in Appalachia. To the west, you got all this farmland. And I was scrolling around looking at the farmland, and I kept going. Like, you can go on across to the west, and you see Indiana and Illinois and Iowa.
Oh, my gosh.
All these states that are, when you take the bird's eye view, they're ecologically decimated.
Yeah, it's
very
sad.
They're just like corn and soy farms. And most of those are owned by corporations. They just own huge swaths of the Midwest. Like, the vision there is, we could repopulate this place. A lot of the towns there have gotten to be places that weren't well cared for, weren't well loved. It's like, if we were to have a repopulation, you could see those towns becoming vibrant. If we could somehow turn the farms over into places that had healthy soil and could produce for the long term, that integrated wildlife habitat, so that you had
the prairie back.
Yeah. You know, right. And you had some of that, like tall grass and short grass prairies, like, it could be really amazing. So I feel like the vision is there for a different infrastructure and a different structure. But like you say, Jason, our culture and beliefs aren't there to get those things.
It's currently build giant gleaming glass cities and keep letting the machines do what they're doing out in the rural areas.
But here's maybe where there's might be a crack or a slight shift in the Overton window. And that is, I think people recognize, I'm talking about the United States, I don't know what it's like in other countries necessarily, but we do have a political divide in this country that has to do with population density in many ways, right?
Yeah.
And if we recognize that divide is leading to such consternation, partisanship, hostility, potential violence, which we've talked about before, and the way to address that is not to necessarily double down on those things and invest in a power struggle,
right?
Because as you said before, the cities may be rich financially, but they're poor in terms of resources, right? You're not going to win that fight. So if it's about our reconciliation and understanding, and we also have a situation where that's a political environment, we have a situation where I think there's recognition on the part of federal government, state governments, and in many places that we have to address the climate crisis. We have to mitigate climate. We've got to think about climate resilience and adaptation. And there's dollars and programs set to that, including like a climate conservation corps or something like that. So, you know, if we shift a little bit of our thinking and understanding about what that looks like, so we say we address climate not just by trying to get people into building solar panels and wind turbines, you know, and maybe not even just going and trying to do forest stewardship stuff, which is important, but actually sending people into the agrarian part of the country to learn skills and to rebuild these communities, actually making an economic program where you're actually having a cultural exchange too, where you're taking, maybe you're taking well-intentioned college students or recent graduates and you're sending them into these environments to build relationships and to build resilience of those communities and rebuild food systems and regenerative agriculture. I don't know. That sounds maybe Pollyannish, but
I'd vote for you, buddy.
Oh, thank you.
Well,
you and maybe my wife.
No,
that's about it.
I think it's a really cool idea, but the key is, how do we get it going? And I got a great idea.
Why?
Everybody needs to get out there on YouTube.
Yeah.
Start watching some Green Acres episodes.
Okay.
So that you get primed for how to live an agrarian life.
That's genius, man. I'll vote for you too.
Do 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 do.
That's our show. Thanks for listening. If you like what you heard and you want others to consider these issues, then please share Crazy Town with your friends. Hit that share button in your podcast app or just tell them face to face. Maybe you can start some much needed conversations and do some things together to get us out of Crazy Town. Thanks again for listening and sharing.
The visionaries behind Saudi Arabia's The Line Project and Elon Musk's Boring Company have partnered to bring you Caverno Architecturo. The record-scorching summer of 2023 has made one thing totally clear. We fucked up. So now, more than ever, human ingenuity, innovation, and mass delusion are needed to ensure our flourishing in the face of our faceplant. To do so, Caverno Architecturo combines ancient wisdom with modern technology to ensure human progress in spite of the Anthropocene sucking so, so very bad. Our first project will consist of 10,000 vertical boreholes converted into luxury condos in depleted oil fields in the Permian Basin of Texas, transforming an area that is now blazing hot and awful into an underground home for 10 million people. Caverno Architecturo, believing we might survive in luxury caves.
Crazy town, da 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 da, crazy town.